WTVQ.
Hello and welcome to Shannon's Corner. I am Shannon Devereaux Sanford, and I thank you so much for joining us here today on your favorite radio station. Perfect. Thank you. On your favorite radio station, WTBQ. And don't forget, we are now 93.5 FM, as well as our very faithful 1110 AM. And I hope you're doing great today. Actually, no one's really doing great today. Yesterday's news is just dreadful. I mean, it's just one of those things. We live in fear, and then something happens, and that just bring us back all that fear. Justice. Is there justice in this? So we're going to talk about justice today with my guest, who I'm very pleased to have on. He has written a brilliant book. I actually think this is brilliant, and I hope everything of the way he feels his humanity about justice is true, because I'd like to believe that. Unfortunately, I am one of the 20% that he talks about in his book that kind of really don't believe that much more in justice, and I want to. So I'm very excited about his book, excited about him as a guest. Burke Strunsky is a senior deputy district attorney in Riverside County, California. He was elected prosecutor of the year, of the county, I'm sorry, in 2008 and 2011. And as I said, he has a book out, The Humanity of Justice, Lighting Even the Darkest Path Towards Justice, which is what he talks about in his book. And I want to welcome Burke Strunsky to Shannon's Corner. How are you today?
I'm great, Shannon. Thanks for having me.
Well, thank you so much for joining us. What do you think of yesterday's events? I mean, obviously, they're awful. No one can think anything but. But what are your thoughts as a prosecutor? What is your thoughts on this?
Well, just being a homicide prosecutor for long enough, my thoughts instantly go to the victims and their families more than kind of a overall, what does this mean for America? Mm. I think about this 8-year-old boy, Martin, that was one of the three known individuals killed. And my heart just goes out to his family. I deal with these families, and I see their strength, and I know what they go through, and especially when it involves a child. Mm. My hearts and prayers go out to all the victims.
Yeah, no question.
That family.
As a parent, I feel the same. But what do you think? Does this make us more? I mean, obviously, this makes us more. For you wrote an article in the Huffington Post, looking beyond Sandy Hook. Do our children believe that violence is as American as apple pie? I think it's not just our children. Are we starting to think that this is just part of America, that we live with violence all the time?
I think when we are so engulfed by violence, whether it's on TV, video games, or movies, and then we see these events on the news, obviously we begin to think that we live in a very violent culture. But we also got to realize that homicide, though it's tragic and it happens way too much in the United States, is something that ultimately we can do a lot to prevent. And I think when we look at our culture, which has somewhere around 11,000 gun-related tragedies every year, we need to really start taking a close look at why that is in America. And that was the point of the article, to kind of expose why there might be that we're suffering these great amount of deaths.
Well, when you put it out there, often that's what you get back. I mean, we put it out there in videos, we put it out there in movies, so it comes back to us, not in the form of entertainment, obviously, and it only takes a few. Of millions of people, we only need a few to do something and think like this. And, of course, in any big society, there's going to be trouble like that. But you also talk about guns. You are a gun owner. You believe in guns. But you also feel that guns are part of the problem, right?
I do. And, you know, I mean, there's this there's this sense that I get out of this recent national debate post-Sandy Hook that we can really tell you who the good guys are and who the bad guys are, and that's kind of been the mantra for both sides in saying we need to keep the guns out of the hands of the bad guys, the criminals. But, what I realize as a criminal prosecutor is it's not that simple. I mean, the vast majority of murders, and I think people would be surprised about this, at least the majority of murders involve someone that the victim knew.
Yeah.
Most of these occur during heated arguments or other times, and most women that are killed with guns are killed in their homes. So, you know, we need to really take a close look at how these guns are getting in the hands of people that ultimately use them for bad purposes. But to say that we can tell who the bad guys and the good guys are, I don't think that's quite that simple.
No, I agree. And most are crimes of passion more than just random acts of violence. But how about how about these guns that are not meant to protect us? I mean, they are just really meant to hurt people. It's one thing to believe in the Second Amendment and have the right to bear arms. It's another thing to have the right to have machines that kill people that are just meant to really harm people, not necessarily to protect yourself, right? Why can't we just ban them?
Well, I agree with you. I mean, obviously, I don't think anybody needs AR-15s to either defend themselves or go hunting or any kind of these legitimate purposes that guns are used for. So I would argue that those should be banned. But here's the problem that I see with that debate is that is a fraction of the amount of people that are killed every year with guns. And so in some ways, and the situation at Sandy Hook is an absolute tragedy, and it really kind of brings forward the danger of these weapons. But the reality is, every day in our country, 32 to 33 people are killed with guns. A lot of those are handguns. So that's every day of the year, 365 days a year, we see a Sandy Hook tragedy. Mm-hmm. And so what we need to realize is, yeah, banning those kind of assault weapons, it's probably a good idea in a civilized society, but at the same time, it's not going to make a huge difference in where the real gun deaths are occurring, which is every day on the streets in which 30-something people die. So I hope that we can focus on that, too, in this discussion, and I think that's kind of gotten lost and where we are with at least the political debate.
You work in the court systems. You see the worst of the worst. This is not, your reward is making it better. Your reward is, as you write brilliantly in your book, is about seeing humanity. But you see the angry side of life. You see the negative side of life. You see all the bad stuff. Do you think that there's more anger? I once read that 100 years ago, everybody had a gun in their house because they hunted. They lived on farms. And people didn't kill people very often. Why is there so much anger? If everybody could or should have a gun, years ago they didn't use them. Why is there so much anger that we're using them in such a negative way now?
You know, I think for the most part, we're not. The reality is the most people use their guns responsibly, and most people either hunt or protect their homes and use them responsibly. The problem is that we have so many guns out there, 310 million at the last estimate, at least, and growing, that we're no longer able to control how the guns are getting into the hands of people that shouldn't have them. And when we talk about even basic common sense legislation, like trying to close some of these loopholes on the background checks, you see that we get this significant pushback on even things that seem common sense. I mean, get a background check before you buy a gun. It doesn't seem, we've had this in California for many years, and we have somewhere around 600,000 plus gun sales a year. So you can see that there's still a really robust gun trade. It doesn't limit your ability to sell the weapons. It just puts a little more paperwork in the process. We go through the TSA line at the airport. I don't, and because I feel safer, I like the fact that I have to take off my shoes and go through that whole process. And because I can sit there with my 2-year-old daughter and my wife and feel safe when I fly on a plane. I feel the same way about guns. I mean, we should absolutely have a Second Amendment to possess guns in our homes. The Heller decided that in 2008. That was the Supreme Court decision. It was unequivocal. It said, there can be some restrictions, but you basically have the right to either have a handgun or a shotgun. So nobody's coming to take anybody's guns away. But having these common sense restrictions, I think, will help do what we want to do, which is keep the hands of the guns out of the hands of people that should not have them.
Including children. I mean, that's something people are talking about now, that if a child gets their hand on a parent's gun, a teenager, a younger kid, like we heard recently in the Northeast, a 6-year-old was killed by a gun that he found under his father's bed. Shouldn't the parents be prosecuted for something like that?
I think they should, and the reality is, there has to be, with a right comes a responsibility, and that responsibility is, if you have a gun in the house, you're responsible if somebody uses that gun in a way that they shouldn't. In other words, if your child picks up the gun and kills somebody, or a child kills himself, and the reality is that, this kind of illusion that guns are used in a significant degree for self-defense is not really well-founded. We do use guns for self-defense. I want to have a gun in my house. Mm-hmm. But when people argue that there's these millions and millions of times that guns are used for self-defense every year, it's just not true. The reality is there's about 11,000 homicides in the United States every year. 9,000 plus are with guns. And there's only about 215 justifiable homicides in the United States. So that's like a ratio of somewhere around 42 to 1.
Wow.
Just to give you a sense of how rare it is compared to the homicide rate. I'm not suggesting that right should in any way be infringed, but we have to kind of be realistic about the danger and the value of guns.
Yeah, I mean, self-defense is one thing. Using them as they should not be used is another, and it's very hard to regulate people. I mean, you're in the business of justice. How can you really regulate people? It's very hard to say you can have this, but you have to use it responsibly. I mean, that's the point that the people that are anti-gun often make, is that we can't tell them how to use it. If you give it to them, you give it to them, and if they're out there, criminals can get their hands on them. You know, you work, as I keep saying, in the criminal justice system. You have written this really wonderful book, and you really believe in humanity, don't you? You are not jaded by everything you see. You still believe that we are good on the inside, don't you?
I do, and I think that the criminal justice system, and this is going to come as a surprise probably to some of your listeners, is really a reflection of our the better aspects of who we are. And I talk about this in my book, how language, emotion, violence, community, faith, all these things kind of come into play in the criminal justice system in a way that really functions very well, and is kind of personified by our jury system. And I think we often look at the criminal justice system as a broken system. I think, you know, if you read some of the books out there now, they really deal with the times the criminal justice system has let us down. You know, the time where somebody is released years after a conviction, where they're determined that they didn't commit the crime through DNA evidence, or on the flip side, somebody like Casey Anthony or O.J. Simpson, who the vast majority of people think got away with murder. And so what you don't see is all the times that the system functions well, really takes these monsters off the street and puts them in prison, and the jury system is a big part of that. But what gives me humanity, I think, more than anything, is the strength of the victims' families that I deal with every day, and the dignity that they show in a way I can't even kind of, you know, can't even tell you. They stand in court, they come to court every day, they watch as the defendant gets his due process and is kind of coddled by the system in a lot of ways, and they keep their heads high, and they bring in pictures of their loved one, and they show a remarkable sense of dignity and respect.
Well, and of course they really you know, count on you. I mean, there's no question that you are doing for them what they cannot do for themselves and getting some justice. And I think, you know, justice is so important. And I think often it just gets so overlooked because of so many little loopholes. I mean, Alan Dershowitz, you know, years ago wrote a book about the best defense, that it's really about winning and losing, not a matter of right and wrong. And is that what you, a lot of people are taught in law school? And that's what we think. I think the average person thinks that it's really not about justice anymore. It's about winning a case, regardless of whether you think he's guilty or not. But you still believe in justice, and you still see justice in our system, right?
I do, and I think to some respects, you know, what the defense's job is to put the prosecution through the paces and make sure that the prosecution's able to prove their case, and that there aren't fundamentally either process problems or substantive problems with the case. And I think what that does is gives the jury a reassurance that, yeah, they've heard all the facts. They know the defense's side. They know our side, the prosecution side. And so they really feel ultimately that they can deliver justice. So I have great respect for the other side for the most part. Obviously, there's some bad apples on both sides when you deal with lawyers. But ultimately, I think the jury needs to see and feel that the defense has tested the prosecution evidence in order for them to feel comfortable imposing justice. So it is to some extent about winning and losing, but not necessarily in a negative way. I think the defense's job is to test the case and to make sure that all due process considerations have been met. And when they are, that's when we can lower the hammer and actually give the defendant justice.
Right. Well, it takes, you know, you have to have all these checks and balances in place. Otherwise, there certainly would be unfair to some. We have to take a quick break. And you're going to stay with us. And when we come back, I want to talk about your book and why you wrote it and what it's about and who it's for. We are talking with Burke Strunsky, and we'll be back here in just a few on WTBQ.
Tim and Bob from the Style Council.
Hello and welcome back to Shannon's Corner. I am Shannon Devereaux Sanford, and I thank you so much for joining us here today. And don't go anywhere, because we are talking about justice, something that's on the minds of everyone in this country right now. And we are talking with Burke Strunsky, who is a senior deputy district attorney in Riverside County, California, and he does wonderful work. He works with, he's really an advocate. I would clearly say he's an advocate for children, and he's an advocate for the justice system. And he has featured on Dateline NBC in 2020 for his his big trials. He writes about them in the book. The book is The Humanity of Justice, Lighting Even the Darkest Path Towards Justice. And this really, truly is a brilliant book. And you have written it in such a humanitarian way. I mean, it's clear that you believe in what you do. You stated in the beginning, which I mentioned earlier, that a Gallup poll shows that 20% of Americans don't have any confidence or little confidence in the criminal justice system. And a little bit more, obviously, a lot more, 76% expressed having some or very little. So clearly, many of us are been disillusioned about the criminal justice system. And your book is a real ray of hope for the system. And why did you write this book, and who needs this book?
Well, I wrote this book because I wanted, one, I felt these cases were incredibly interesting. I mean, that was kind of the bottom line. Is I happened through chance or just through doing enough of them to have some really interesting cases to talk about. And once the stories are out there, I think you begin to see that the criminal justice system has these very human-like qualities. And what my goal was to let other people see these, and hopefully that they'd understand the criminal justice system a little more and begin to appreciate it, and ultimately maybe even work to make it even better. And the other thing is that was valued in me on a personal level is it was kind of a literary therapy. I mean, we deal with somebody's worst day over and over again, and kind of break it down and deconstruct it. And you really, at some point, have to say, well, let me get these stories out of here, and maybe there's also a personal benefit as well. So, there were two parts to why I decided to write the book.
What cases and stories are you talking about? I mean, tell our listeners, the ones that I mentioned that were featured on Dateline and 2020, these were high-profile cases that obviously had a good ending for justice. What were they?
Well, the one that was featured on 2020 is a case that involved a relatively highly respected pastor who essentially took out a ton of insurance on his wife, about $1.5 million, and ultimately staged a break-in and tried to make it look like somebody had broken in, and he basically bludgeoned his wife to death. The second one, same kind of general concept, was featured on Dateline, which showed a husband, a former police chief, who murdered his wife in the backyard spa. So those are two of the cases that dealt with a lot of forensic evidence, that dealt with a lot of kind of CSI type stuff, but also dealt with a lot of common sense and just putting together a motive and ultimately delivering it to the jury. And they came back fortunately, with justice, and those two individuals are serving life sentences as we speak.
You believe in juries, right?
I do. I think the jury, when I look at a jury, some people worry about juries giving this case over to 12 mm-hmm. people that don't know too much about the criminal justice system. But I think the jury really is kind of this collective wisdom of 12 people. They see things that neither the prosecution or the defense or the judge or anybody else sees. And it always amazes me having these conversations with juries after the trial is they'll point out some piece of evidence that nobody else saw. No, not the cops, not the police, not the prosecutor, not the defense, not the judge. So they see cases because they work with 12 minds in a way that we could never see them. And ultimately, I think that leads to justice, and there is a sense of the values of the community being reflected in that jury. So I have great confidence in the jury pool. Obviously, sometimes they don't get it right. Sometimes they don't get it right in cases I've dealt with. But ultimately, if you're looking for justice and you have kind of those democratic values that we have in the United States, there really is no better way to find justice.
Yeah, no, I agree with that. I think it's very important. What about capital punishment? Some of these crimes that you're talking about, these horrendous crimes, do you believe we should have capital punishment?
I believe in capital punishment on a very limited level. I think you really have to look at who is the worst of the worst. And it really has, when you compare the worst of the worst, you're talking about the worst of the murderers. So, you've already kind of established, okay, this is the group we're talking about, the murderers. So who is the worst of the murderers? You're really talking about a very small subset of people. And ultimately, I think there are crimes that transcend the ability of just a prison sentence to give us justice, to give the victims justice, and to differentiate mass murder or a murder that involves torture or other horrible act, and differentiate that from, for lack of a better term, what is a more garden variety type murder, where there isn't those really aggravating circumstances. Obviously, maybe somebody deserves to spend the rest of their life in prison, but most murders are not death penalty type cases. But there are some that we really do need it, and for no other reason than there is a value in this justice. It's frankly what some people deserve at the end of the day. And I think there still is a place for it here in the United States, although that place is obviously, that public opinion on that is changing fairly dramatically.
Yeah, no, it is. It's a very hot button topic. The Humanity of Justice, Lighting Even the Darkest Path Towards Justice, as I said, is really a wonderful book. I find it so enlightening and so inspiring and so helpful to believe in the system that we all really want to believe in. Now, all the proceeds of this go to an organization that you and your wife founded, the Humanity of Justice Foundation. Tell me about that.
Right. The Humanity of Justice Foundation its sole responsibility is to fund programs that help abused and neglected children. So 100% of the proceeds from this book, every cent goes directly to that organization. And ultimately, we pick out, we have a board of directors that picks out programs that we feel based on, and there's several prosecutors, judges involved, people from the Child Protective Services and other organizations. So we really try to make sure we're giving to programs that are really helping those who have suffered abuse, and also to try to invest in programs that ultimately will prevent some abuse as well. And so those are the real goals of the organization.
Yeah, very admirable goals, I must say. Did you always want to be an attorney? You have such a, obviously this suits you so well, and you use it so well. But was this something you always wanted to do?
I did, and you know, I always wanted to actually, more specifically, be a prosecutor. I could never be a defense attorney, certainly, but I could also probably never be that interested in civil law, you know, outside the criminal context wouldn't interest me. And the public service aspects, as well as, look, I love to be in court. I love to argue in court. Kind of the dramatic flair for it is really, for me, is kind of very compelling. It's the life that and the career that, sometimes I'm surprised. I have to think to myself, man, they actually pay me for this. Because it's so so inspiring and so and really satisfies, you know, both my need to be in court as well as give something back to the community. So
I thank you for your work. We're very lucky to have people out there like you. I wish we had more of them, because this is what makes our justice system so good. And it really is, you know, it comes down to the people that work in it. And if we have good, honest people that really care like you, that makes a difference. Then people can start to believe in the justice system. Where can everybody get your book?
They can either go directly to our website at hojf.org, that's Humanity of Justice Foundation.org, or they can buy it on Amazon, the Kindle, or any of the other ebook devices.
All right. For everybody listening, if you're in the car, go to Shannon's Corner. There's a direct link exactly to that website so you can get your book there. Burke Strunsky, I thank you so much for joining us here today on WTBQ and sharing with us your book to our listeners, because it's just a wonderful, brilliant book, and I thank you so much for writing it.
Thanks, Shannon. Appreciate you having me.
Thank you so much for joining us today. And everybody, thank you for joining us today. We do have to wrap it up for today. But until next time, don't forget to make good choices.
Bonasek, Krahulik, Cutterback, McMahon, and Brady, Attorneys at Law, is a full-service, sophisticated law firm serving the Hudson Valley region and beyond. Their staff of 8 attorneys are specialists in a broad range of legal fields, and they have offices in Warwick, Middletown, and Port Jervis for your convenience. They take pride in responding to their clients' needs timely and efficiently. Members of the firm are longtime community residents. Attorneys and staff continue to maintain the same personal touch established with their clients when they were smaller, individual firms, but with the capability of providing one-stop legal services. Call Bonacek, Krahulik, Cutterback, McMahon, and Brady, Attorneys at Law today, to entrust them with any of your legal concerns. 986-1156. Bonasek, Krahulik, Cutterback, McMahon, and Brady. Attorneys at Law. 986-1156. That's 986-1156.